Welcome, everybody, to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 175. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, James Jones.
Hey.
And John Lindemann.
Let's get ready to rumble!
He knows what the score is. And Greg Lay is there also.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
All right. We're all here. We are ready for your holiday-rific show. Actually, this is this show has nothing to do with the holidays. So if you're sick of all that shit, this is the episode for you. We have no special plans whatsoever. We're gonna do new business and listener mail. And John is first.
My new business is a game that is near and dear to my heart, Blaster Master by Sunsoft.
Holla,
which came out for Virtual Console this week. Much to my glee.
It didn't come out. It debuted in grand fashion.
Yes, it did. And actually, it's kind of interesting because Sunsoft really, and, you know, Gaijin Works, I guess, they really kept this under wraps for a while. They only announced it, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
It was even, I mean, and they said they gave it this, you know, yes, it'll be coming out this month sort of date. They didn't actually announce a real date for it, but it did come out this week, and I downloaded it, and I love it. This was one of the games. Actually, I still have a copy of this game in the box, manual, in pristine shape, sitting at home. Well, at my mom's place.
Kohler's got six, so don't brag.
I'm sure he does. So this is like kind of one of... I mean, I bought this game as soon as it came out. I probably bought this game shortly after I bought my NES, because I bought my NES a little bit later because I was infatuated with Sega's awful Master System, but...
And Space Area in 3D. I mean, come on. Screw you, Avatar. Been there, done that.
3-ish D.
Yeah, so I was trying to think about what elements. I mean, it does crib elements, I think, from Metroid, from the original Zelda also.
Mm-hmm.
The whole plot is, you know, paper thin. Basically, you're a boy named Jason, I believe, and... You have a pet frog.
That's a solid name.
Yeah, and of course, this is all spelled out in about three little cutscenes at the very beginning of the game.
Good.
You mean three frames.
Yeah, like three. They're not even cutscenes, you're right. They're just three frames.
Three screens.
And you see your frog jump down a hole, and of course, you have to chase after your frog, so you chase after your frog. And there is a huge...
Frog?
It's like this vehicle.
Hole?
This vehicle there, and you hop into it, has a big cannon on it. And so pretty much the game is you can drive around this underground area, very, very Super Metroid-y, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can shoot at things with your vehicle. But the cool thing about it, and the thing that was very novel at the time, was that you could actually get out of your vehicle, and you become this little teeny-weeny guy with a massive head. And, and you get out of your vehicle actually in the, I guess you could call it an overworld area where you're fighting monsters, but you can enter caves, and then it shifts to a different viewpoint, and you kind of walk around as the guy in like an overhead view, and, you know, shooting monsters. They're all like robots and stuff like that, collecting power-ups. And so the way that these caves kind of act as an area to power up, and it's also where you fight the boss characters. It's really, really good. I mean, at the time, I remember I was just really, really impressed by it. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Johnny, do you think that you could actually say that games after it were probably influenced by it? I never really thought of it that way, but it was kind of doing stuff that we take for granted now, but it was doing it really early. I mean, it came out in 88.
I'm not sure which games you could say were directly influenced by it. I do think my feeling on Blaster Master is that the guys who made it looked at Nintendo's original Metroid, which would have come out 2-3 years earlier,
mm-hmm.
and said, hey, this has a lot of cool ideas, but it sucks. Let's make a better version of it. And they totally did, you know. I mean, you know, I love Metroid, but the original Metroid is janky and crazy. And Blaster Master feels like a much more polished version of Metroid on NES.
Yep.
It is, and you're right to compare it to Super Metroid, because it's actually a little bit closer to Super Metroid in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I think it's brilliant. And yeah, I downloaded it the day it came out on Virtual Console this week, and I've been playing it a lot. I think I'm on the fourth level. I think it holds up incredibly well. I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
I think the graphics, the controls, the music are all really fantastic. I mean, this is like top shelf NES stuff. It is definitely one of the best NES games. I mean, the story you mentioned is kind of silly. You might not, I think if you don't wait for the attract sequence to come up, you might not ever even know that there is a story.
Isn't it something like it was different for the West? Like it was just a pure mech game in Japan, and then they added this thing about the boy and his frog?
Right, yeah. In Japan, it's called Metafight, and the legend is that when they decided to publish it in America, you know, Sunsoft USA or whoever was in charge of localizing it said, well, Americans are going to want some kind of story here so they can...
So we had a frog.
No, the frog was actually already in the game.
Oh.
The frog is one of the bosses about halfway through the game, so they actually just kind of went backwards from that and, you know, tried to explain why there would be a giant frog in this underground cavern.
I like that they're concerned about the need for the giant frog's backstory, but not the need for the giant mech suit you find down a hole.
Right. It's just there. There's this giant tank that jumps. Well, and that's really the best part of the game. I mean, the parts when you get out of the tank are not as good. They're okay. They're very quirky. Like there's a very... It's kind of... It reminds me a little bit of Ease, the RPG series,
where
you kind of have to learn this weird battle system where you never fight something head on. You always kind of come at it a little bit off center.
Yes.
And, you know, you kind of have to learn to game the AI and everything.
Mm. Well, so also there's a lot of, you know, things are there off screen, but you can't see them until you're right on top of them and they hit you.
Oh, good.
Sometimes.
So, yeah. I mean, it's not something that's game breaking or anything like that. But, you know, like Johnny said, you kind of learn to game the AI. Like
you have to.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going into an area where you can't see what's up ahead of you, you just instantly start shooting as soon as, like, before you even jump. You just start shooting.
Yeah.
So you don't get hit by something in midair.
Sounds a lot like Castlevania, you know, with the jumping skeletons, you know, get the whip ready, it's going to happen.
It has elements of that as well.
I don't think it's that frustrating, but what I really have been so impressed with Blaster Master this week, playing it again for the first time in at least a decade, is that it actually remembers which enemies you've injured and which enemies you've killed. And as John said, once the enemy's off screen, you can't hurt it, it can't hurt you. And you have to force the screen to scroll in order to re-engage the enemy. But if you've already hit it three times, it will still be, you know, mostly dead.
Yeah.
So this style of playing, it kind of encourages a lot of hit-and-run tactics. So it teaches you to play the game sort of conservatively, which you need to do anyway, but it's quite a difficult game. I think it's mostly a fair kind of difficulty, but it is certainly very challenging, and it requires a lot of good dexterity. But it also requires a good bit of strategy in how you approach enemies. You kind of want to deal with enemies one at a time. You kind of want to shoot it until it's dead before you move on to the next one. And, you know, if it starts fighting back or it starts chasing you, you kind of want to move off the screen so you take it out of the equation until you can kind of regroup and go back at it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, a lot of the times when you get killed, it's really your own fault most of the time. I mean, you run into a lot of stronger enemies where early on in the game, if you get hit two or three times, it's not a big deal. But, you know, the stakes get higher as you go on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very fair game, like Johnny said, in the sense that, you know, you just didn't play that enemy the way you were supposed to. You didn't back off when you were supposed to. You just kind of screwed it up.
And the tank portion of the game, which is the best part for sure, is very exploratory. It's very vertical, a surprising amount for an NES game. It's actually, I mean, Metroid is very vertical, but in Metroid, the original Metroid, of course, I'm talking about on NES, every area is either completely horizontal or completely vertical. It wasn't until Metroid 2 and Super Metroid where they had these large area rooms where you could go kind of up and across. So you had more of like a two-dimensional map to explore. In the original Metroid, it's all hallways or vertical tunnels. And Blaster Master is more like Super Metroid in that you have these, you know, these large areas where there's really a lot of ground to cover. There's multiple ways to get around. One thing John didn't mention is that after you kill the boss in the kind of the overhead stuff, you pick up a part for your tank, and then you go back to the tank, and now your tank can do something different. So it can walk on walls, it can fly, it can move underwater, it can shoot more powerful shots that break through walls. And you have to use this stuff to not only find, you know, some kind of secret helpful stuff, but also to get to the next area. It's weird because as you go between areas, they're labeled Area 1, Area 2, Area 3, but the game is not nearly as linear as that would imply. I mean, after you beat the third boss in Area 3, you get the hover upgrade, and you actually have to go all the way back to the first screen of the game and use the hover to get up to a ledge that you couldn't get up to before, and that takes you to the fourth area. So it's really a lot more sophisticated than you might realize when you first start playing it. There's a lot going on here. And yeah, a lot of this stuff isn't explained very well. You know, it was the kind of thing back in the 80s, very much like Metroid. The way you explore that game and the way that your abilities allow you to get to new areas is not spelled out at all. So you either have to just keep trying and until you figure it out, or you go to some kind of strategy guide.
Yeah, I mean, back when this game came out, I mean, this was the golden age of the gaming magazine. Like, this was just when I think this may have come out actually before EGM came out, but this was like EGM, GamePro, all those magazines. And I know I may have thrown it out, but at some point, I did have a gaming magazine that mapped out every single level in this game.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, which would be incredibly helpful because there's no guide whatsoever. I mean, nothing. Yeah. Right. There's no map anywhere for anything.
Right. I was just thinking, you know, I know there were some sequels to Blaster Master. There was one for Genesis, and I've heard kind of mixed things about that one. There was one for PlayStation 1 that is pretty much hated by everyone. And I actually played it for like 30 seconds at E3 a long time ago. I don't remember much about it, but it apparently did not turn out well. Yes, I played PS1 games on. I'm pretty sure it was PS1.
We're still going in 2000.
2000, yeah. That's when it would have been. So anyway, I was just thinking that it would be amazing to get some kind of Blaster Master Rebirth kind of a thing for WiiWare or DS or something like that to take the same basic gameplay, but give you new areas, nicer graphics, a couple extra power-ups, give you an auto map, which would help so much.
Yep.
And, you know, I think that the top-down, you know, stuff where you're walking around as the kid and you have your gun, I think that stuff is worth keeping, but, you know, polish it up a little bit, make it a little more modern, make it feel not quite as janky, and it would be incredible. I really would love that if they just really stuck close to the original formula but just kind of modernized all of it a little bit.
Yeah.
That would be amazing, and you know, who knows, maybe that's a possibility now with everything that's happening.
What was it, like Thunder Force, Technosoft or whatever, they went defunct. But someone bought the rights to the Thunder Force name and the Technosoft name and did a Thunder Force 6, and it was, you know, that sort of thing. I don't think it turned out that great.
What the world needed.
It's kind of, you know what I mean, like that, it'd be a similar sort of thing probably, in terms of they had to get a new kind of, you know, they're having the rights to the name, they'd have to find the right development house to do it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, when they announced that they were, you know, the whole Sunsoft, you know, deal that Sunsoft was coming back and everything, they specifically said that they have the rights to do all of that kind of stuff, so we could easily see some remakes.
And given their pace of announcing and doing things, we could see some remakes.
It'll be about 3 weeks.
Tomorrow.
It's interesting, though, I mean, because this sounds, you know, I'd love to play this, and you know how much
you,
I enjoy
you
playing
You would really enjoy it,
games.
Greg.
It's such
but,
a
but
good
I
game.
Haven't heard anything about the situation in Japan or Europe vis-a-vis re-releasing a Blaster Master, but in general, it's good to see this kind of slightly more enterprising attitude come into Virtual Console. We had LucasArts stuff, not so long ago, as well. So after the sort of big dormant period that kind of went on at the start of last year, up until, you know, well into this one, hopefully these are doing well, because it'll stimulate more, presumably, if these kinds of, as I said, more entrepreneurial kind of activities actually go very nicely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really surprised there's not more of it, because, I mean, this is just easy money, really. I mean,
you would think so, but there's been such a dearth of this kind of thing. I mean, maybe now they just see the fact that Nintendo's kind of switched off the tap and think, well, now there's a gap in the market. You know, there's people that do want to buy stuff. You know, some people every week, other people every few weeks, you know, downloadable stuff. They're kind of like a steady diet of downloadable games. And, you know, if the big publishers like Capcom and Konami and Nintendo have kind of run out, let's get in there and see it. So, you know, maybe that's what it is.
Well, see, I wouldn't be surprised if there is money out there for the taking, but it's just not big amounts. So you'd have to basically sell not just a lot of individual games, but a lot of games, period, to really recoup significant financial reward from it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, that's one of the things we really don't have an insight into, and is really how many of these, how well these games sell. I mean, you know, the big Nintendo titles sell a lot, but even that we don't know.
No, we have no clue.
No, you just know which ones are kind of most popular from the channel itself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it spits out relative. The most popular, but yeah, there's no absolute numbers, and you don't know the cost structures exactly.
And we don't even know that channel is even accurate. I mean,
yeah, well, it's not transparent what's going into that.
For all we know, it could be these are the games we want to sell, so they
are. We
want
to keep selling Mario 3. Yeah. Not enough people have Mario 3.
You know, I don't want to predict the success of Blaster Master, but I do think it is absolutely the perfect kind of game to be released on Virtual Console, and I'll give you three reasons. Number one, it's amazing. It's actually one of the best games on that system that was ever made, and it still had not been put on there. So that's huge, is that it's actually worth paying for and playing through. I mean, I'm going to try to finish it, you know, and I do that with very, very, very few Virtual Console games. Number two, it enjoys really widespread nostalgia, at least in the U.S. I don't know how other regions feel about it, but I know that Blaster Master was pretty much ubiquitous in the late 80s.
Yeah, see, yeah. I can't say it's one of those ones that I've heard the name, but the specifics are kind of new to me, so maybe it wasn't a big deal elsewhere.
It was very, very, very popular in America. Mm-hmm. Very. And especially considering it wasn't licensed, it wasn't a franchise, really. It wasn't related to anything else. You know, it just kind of came out of the blue, and people said, "Dude, this tank jumps."
Yeah, and you know, and it does the cool thing with its cannon when you press up.
Uh oh.
Yeah, it's nice because the gun moves up. It's very much like shooting up straight up with Samus, except because it's a tank, it sort of raises up on the treads, on the wheels, you know, and it doesn't exactly transform, but it kind of, the wheels come closer together to push the body of the tank upwards. It's really, really good animation.
So it's like if Samus had tank treads instead of legs.
Yeah, and my number three reason
fantasy.
That this is a perfect Virtual Console release is that it's unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can say shares this and that with other games, but there's nothing really like Blaster Master, and so it's an experience that is not already replicated. I mean, I think companies like Hudson really messed up on Virtual Console, and maybe they didn't have much choice given their library.
I think they just took the option of almost releasing everything. I mean, especially in Japan... It's the approach of releasing everything, and if that means you release a hell of a lot of shooters and
guys, do you have any scrolling shooters
end up contributing
left?
To the severe redundancy of several versions of Street Fighter 2, then so be it. You know,
I can't wait to get it for TurboGrafx-16. That's going to be amazing.
You know, you can say what you want about Nintendo's strategy in releasing their first-party stuff on Virtual Console, but I think what Nintendo has done successfully is they've basically curated their little corner, well, their big corner of Virtual Console by releasing their games slowly, deliberately, and they mix it up so that they don't release five platformers in a row.
Trying to avoid cannibalization at all costs. That seems to be the biggest concern of that. Whereas, I mean, the Hudson stuff has been a bit more of an all-you-can-eat approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and eventually your eyes glaze over at this stuff. So I think, you know, it's very, very compelling to us major users of Virtual Console, the people who actually pay attention to what's released on that platform. It's very compelling to us to see something released that's different from everything else that's being released all the time. And the stuff that's being released all the time is, you know, a lot of these games are actually very good, but there's so much other stuff that it's not clear why we would want this versus something else. Whereas Blaster Master, it's very clear.
Especially when you're dealing with a library now, even in the US, which is well over 300 games strong, you know, it's going to fade into the background pretty easily, a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really helps to be able to set yourself aside, to get people talking, and to give that game a little bit of room to breathe. Whereas if next week they release Blaster Master 2 for Genesis, they're not going to get nearly as much buzz around it. I mean, I don't think they're going to, but... They could, technically, and I think that would be a mistake. They should wait at least a month because, you know, they want people to play Blaster Master and to talk about it and tell their friends and get their friends to play it.
Mm-hmm. And they've got these other properties that they've licensed, the Gaijin works or whatever.
They got the Telenet stuff.
Yep. The Telenet stuff. I remember when John mentioned Valis last week. I've heard that before. And I remembered where I've heard it from, is that Shane Bettenhausen constantly threatened a Valis special on Retronauts.
Yeah, there's a ton of games in that series. Valis 1, yeah. 2, 3, and I think there's also spin-off games.
There's a Super Valis 4.
Well, the thing is, too, those games have been made across three or four different platforms.
So we get a Wonderland monster.
Oh, monster God, yeah. There's your virtual console redundancy.
Wonder
right
Boy
there,
and Monster.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a complete mess. Mm-hmm. And,
honestly, I could use a few more Wonder Boy games. I have a whole SD card full of Wonder Boy titles. I think I need to start card 2.
Well, speaking of downloadable stuff, other than Blaster Master, the only new business I want to mention this week is some Beatles Rock Band DLC. Of course, Beatles came out in September, and I've been playing it off and on since then. Usually every couple of weeks, I'll bust it out and play a little bit. But the main events have been very regular schedule every month since the game came out. They've released an album. So in October, it was Abbey Road. In November, it was Sgt. Pepper. And then this month in December, it's Rubber Soul. And certainly they are three of the Beatles' best albums, three of the best albums ever made. I'm still waiting on Revolver, which is my personal favorite. I think they have to do Revolver. It's got way too many great, important songs that people actually recognize. It would be stupid not to do it. But, you know, after Revolver, I feel like they've pretty much covered the bases with the Beatles, and from there, you know, I'm not really sure albums are the right way to go after that. Maybe do some singles. But I just did want to mention it in that at this point, I've paid for the Beatles twice over, but to be fair, I've more than doubled the number of songs that originally came with it. And, you know, obviously this music is great, but the DLC is extremely well done. So, I mean, not only are they fun to play on guitar and bass and all that, but they did a really nice job with the presentation. And looking at these songs, I think for the most part they're remixing elements that were used in the visual presentation for the disc songs, and I think they had put in a couple of sort of sleeper elements that they knew would be used for these.
Yeah, they
albums.
Were already on the disc waiting to be used. Mm-hmm. But
I think there were a couple of assets. It's really minor stuff, but you know, it's nothing really major, and certainly the music itself was not on the disc. That's pretty obvious given the size of the downloads and everything.
No Professor Layton here.
No. They were planning this DLC, and that may be part of the reason why they haven't announced Revolver yet. It's just because it's, you know, maybe that would be the first album that they didn't pre-plan for, and so there's a little more work that would go into preparing that for download. But the DLC is extremely well done, and I think if I brought my friends over and we played through a mixture of the original content and the DLC, my friends wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And for a game like Beatles Rock Band, with the presentation that it brings to the table, that's saying
big
a lot.
Big deal, yeah.
That's a big deal. Because even the new songs that I've downloaded, they look amazing. I mean, God, you go into Sgt. Pepper and play Within Without You, it is crazy. I mean, that song is fucked up on the screen. And that's you know, that's a huge part
it's
of the
part
appeal.
Of the challenge.
It's actually a bit distracting in how awesome it looks. That it's hard to concentrate on the note pattern. But I mean, you know, people, especially if you have any spectators at your Rock Band party or whatever, people really appreciate that stuff.
Yeah.
And I've had numerous occasions to play Beatles with friends, and I think people are mesmerized by it. You know, they love it. They love the songs. They don't necessarily, you know, and I don't know all the songs on there either. There's some fairly obscure stuff, even though I'm a big Beatles fan. But everybody knows at least half the songs in this game, and most people know almost all of them. And that is a huge difference from what you're used to with these rhythm games. And with the DLC stuff, you know, I can load up Rubber Soul and play it in its entirety, 14 songs. And I have friends who would actually want to do that with me. They're not necessarily gamers. Mm-hmm. You know, let's jump in there and play 40 minutes Beatles Rock Band.
I guess,
yeah,
if you're going to have more emphasis on the presentation, it just makes it more inclusive as an experience because,
it does.
You know, if it's ruthlessly functional for the player who might, you know, want just not, you know, not to be distracted, then it feels very much like it's just for them, and that all there is the sound, you know. So there's no real, if you were having friends over, a little party or whatever, there wouldn't really be an imperative for them to watch what's going on. But, you know, if you do put in the effort and then everyone feels included in it, then in a weird way it might actually make them more likely to then want to actually get involved and pick up the controller.
I do feel like the Beatles is a special product. It really does set itself apart from everything else, and I do think it is the best rhythm game overall, and primarily because of that presentation. It's something that I never thought was important before this game. I always thought, yeah, they're improving the graphics. Who cares, you know?
I think the only comparable thing I could think of in terms of the potential for incorporating, you know, those elements of the band's identity and things into a really vigorous presentation would be Pink Floyd. But I don't think we'll ever see that, unfortunately.
I don't either, and supposedly Nick Mason is, you know, kind of opposed to it, and yeah. I don't know. If Dave and Roger want to do it, I think Nick will go along with whatever they tell him to. But he just seems like that kind of a guy. But
now, what about Green Day Rock Band? What do you think about that?
Probably
opening up a can of worms with that.
I mean,
you
can bemoan as much as you want, but they've been around long enough, and they have changed.
Oh, they've been around forever. They've been around since I was a little kid.
And I mean, their image has morphed considerably since when they started. So, I mean, you could argue that they could do it.
Yeah, but
it's still a long way down from the Beatles. So.
I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that they do have that kind of evolving image you could work with.
They've got a richer heritage than your average sort of punk kind of act.
I guess so, but, you know, obviously I'm not a huge fan of Green Day. I never have been, not since the days of Dookie when all my friends were listening to them.
Yeah.
But I don't think, for one thing, I don't really think Green Day songs would be that much fun to play. They're mostly power chords and, you know, really rhythmic stuff. It just, and the main thing is there's not that much musical diversity in what they do. Like, I know American Idiot has some parts to it that are a little bit out there, but nothing compared to, I mean, dude, the Beatles, like, listen to Sgt. Pepper and, you know, like, there's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it might be commercially, it might make sense. Certainly makes more sense than Lego Rock Band.
Yeah, that game makes no fucking sense and should not have been made. That's the first game I'm ever going to say should have never been made.
Lego Rock Band, it really makes no sense at all. But
like, can you think of a game that makes less sense than that?
Miami Nights for DSiWare.
No, I don't mean because of its just badness. I mean just like you just can't wrap your head around why this game was made.
Well, you know, it's their band Hero, and they chose to approach it not by just choosing a different word from a rival music game. They said, let's attach the Lego license to it and see what happens.
James, my answer to you is Call of Duty Reflex.
Yeah, well, maybe, but...
I was at the supermarket the other day, and apparently that was the best-selling game there, so...
Yeah, there you go. Right next to the produce
British
section,
British supermarket shoppers say you're wrong.
Anyway, enough about Beatles and Rock Band. Greg, what you got, man?
Well, first of all, I want to say I enjoyed Johnny's appearance on the Combo Breaker podcast last week.
Thanks. I hope I acquitted myself admirably.
Mostly. Although, I will say that I don't wish to seem like a pedant, but I did die just a little inside when tasked with coming up with games to be enthused about on Nintendo platforms in 2010. The words Sin and Punishment 2 didn't escape anyone's lips.
Sorry, I thought it would be coming out in January. Nintendo has since told me otherwise.
I know. So it's not coming out in the first quarter. I am surprised.
Yeah. I thought that was so close to the horizon.
Perhaps they've been locked in a contract battle to get Martin Sheen to voice the cutscenes for Sin and Punishment 2.
Good.
Unfortunately, Mass Effect 1.
He can be Saki.
Yeah. but no, obviously I did enjoy it, and you know, it's a punishment too. When it comes out, will be worth the wait. I assure everyone of that.
So which is why you waited.
But you know, it's a niche sort of title. It's not gonna do it for everyone. I'll be the first to admit that. But yeah, what else? This week I got A Boy and His Blobbin, which is I've only been able to play it for just a short while, so I don't have extensive impressions of it yet. Obviously, it's a very beautiful game. It's got very relaxing music, kind of appropriate for the festive season, actually. I've played the first world. There's like four hub worlds, if you like, with 10 levels in each, and I've got all the each level has like three treasure chests which unlock a sort of a challenge level as well. So I've unlocked all of those, but I haven't actually played those. And I think the difference between the two kinds of level is the normal levels, like death is quite trivial. you die in one hit, but if you die, you pretty much just start where you were. So, you know, there's no real significant penalty. But I think with those challenge level, it's more sort of old school in terms of if you die in one hit, then you start at the beginning of the level again or something. So it's kind of this tiered kind of challenge for the game that they've put in there. But I mean, so far the first world, it's pretty basic in terms of just getting from the start to the end. But getting some of those treasure chests, there were some pretty neat puzzles already. So I'm kind of enthused by that as you get a bit further in it, that there's going to be some ones that are going to challenge you a bit more. And you know, way forward are not afraid of putting pretty steep difficulty curves in their game. So I'm hopeful that that's going to be really quite satisfying when I play into it a bit more. But what I have played a lot of, really quite dominating my gaming time this week, is Spirit Tracks. So I'm really near the end now. I think it's funny, it's almost like the complete opposite of Wind Waker in terms of the way the game's set up with the story and the structure. It actually ends up having a dungeon more than you think it's going to have.
Instead of a dungeon, of course, less.
Wind Waker just threw you a pearl, basically. So that was cool, actually, to get that extra dungeon. And it is a substantial package, especially when you consider you've got this centralized dungeon, the Tower of the Spirits, a bit like the Temple of the Ocean King, but none of the content is repeated. And actually, it is, in my mind, the best stuff in the game. This is where you play with you, Link, and the Phantom character possessed by Zelda, and it's really good. Once it gets going, maybe the first couple of floors are a little simple, but once it gets cooking, there's some really great puzzles. There's stuff where the Phantoms that Zelda can possess actually have different abilities. So you kind of, the gameplay that you have where this kind of co-op gameplay does get more diverse and more sophisticated as you go. You get these puzzles that are quite different from anything you've seen in Phantom Hourglass, certainly, or perhaps Zelda in general. So those are really good, really satisfying parts of the game. The normal dungeons outside are more conventional. It's like, you know, you go in there, you make a certain amount of progress, you find the dungeon's main item, and then you use that to get to the rest of the dungeon, and then you fight the boss. And yeah, those are pretty good. I would say not quite as enjoyable as the stuff in the Tower of the Spirits, but I guess some of the disappointment in some cases is that the items are, there's some reprises essentially of Phantom Hourglass stuff, which, you know, is a kind of a little disappointing, because, you know, you've got everything else from Phantom Hourglass, there's the engine and, you know, some of the structure and all this. You kind of like to see them with those individual elements be a bit more diverse, but I still think it's better executed in the main, the dungeon stuff, than in Phantom Hourglass.
I feel like I'm ready for Zelda games to give you the boomerang from the start and not make a big deal of it.
Yeah, exactly.
When I open a treasure chest and it's the boomerang, I'm like, come on.
There's a couple of moments like that in this, and I find that disappointing. Although, I mean, you know, in other cases, there are some cool items. One of the final ones is really quite different from anything you've had before, and it's a neat idea. The execution is a bit wonky, but I'd still rather them do that than just retread the same stuff. Although I will give them credit for coming up with some interesting kind of puzzles around existing items. You know, it's a case they still kind of find some good applications for that. And the boss fights, I think, are quite a big improvement over Phantom Hourglass. They're quite good. I really quite enjoyed those. So all of that stuff's good. So what does that leave? Well, it leaves the overworld stuff. Now, the train is slower than I would like, is the first thing. You know, it just seems to take quite a while to get everywhere. And looking at it from a design point of view, what are the pros and cons of going with this approach? I guess the first thing I'll say is that visually, the scenery and everything is actually a lot more impressive than I was expecting. I mean, I was kind of expecting basically green fields to substitute for the blue ocean, you know, and it would be mostly flat and kind of uninteresting. But actually, at times, it's really, really impressive, and it's quite nice to look at. But, you know, when you're just kind of going along on these train tracks quite slowly, and you're just following a set path, and okay, you have to ward off some enemies, and they kind of work in blowing the whistle because it kind of stuns the enemies or startles them, so you can kind of freeze them and make them easy to shoot and stuff. Yeah, they try and work in these kind of little action elements to it, but it is, you know, a bit of a chore getting from point A to point B. And as in many Zelda games, you know, you start off and it's like, okay, you've completed this dungeon, now go to the next one, now go to the next one, and it goes quite quickly. And then as the game goes on, those bits in between get longer and more complicated. You know, stuff goes, you go to the sanctuary or whatever, and it's like, oh, the guy's not there, you've got to do this first before you get on to the next dungeon. So when it gets a little bit more fetch questy and you start using the train more, that's where it starts to get a little bit more irksome. And I guess the main thing about it, I would say, is that for me, it's tolerable in a portable game because it doesn't command your attention in the same way as a console game. You know, I mean, Johnny, you've talked about, you could kind of play absentmindedly with the TV on in front of you, or if you're traveling or whatever, you know. So it is tolerable, it's not that bad, and they do some things to kind of spruce it up. But the bottom line is, it's not great. I mean, there's just no kind of way around that. But it doesn't, you still, I think the best thing is just that the dungeons are done well enough that you are involved in the game and you really want to see what's coming next, so you're willing to go through this.
That's just a trade-off that we don't need. That makes me a sad panda.
I know what you mean. It's kind of like, you know, yes, it's not that bad, but why have we got it at all? And it's an interesting thing. I mean, because I guess, I don't know, I kind of felt the exploration in Phantom Hourglass was quite trivial.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't happy with it in that game either.
So in some ways, it kind of makes sense to strip it out even more, you know what I mean? It's kind of like when people talk about, you know, the combat and survival horror games and what Silent Hill did with it. Shattered Memories, the new one. It's kind of like, well, you know, if it's in there and it's not very good, maybe you should just take it out. But the problem is they haven't.
The other way is to go like Resident Evil 4 and make the combat good.
Make it better, exactly. But the thing is with this is it isn't really taking it out. It's kind of, you know what I mean? Because you're still traversing these landscapes, but you're just not doing a whole lot. It isn't streamlined enough for me. If you were going to streamline it, they probably should have done it more than they have done, I think. I mean, one of the only complaints I'd have about the puzzle side is that there's still too many of these observation stuff, you know, like, okay, here's a bunch of heads. Draw lines on your map about where they're looking, and then where the lines intersect, dig up something, or, you know, or like the read a bunch of signs and they tell you to open things in a given order, or, you know, a few too many of those, because they're straight out of Phantom Hourglass. You know what I mean? I mean, they are the same ones kind of rejigged around. There's even a bit where you visit the snow village, which is almost a complete reprise of a part in Phantom Hourglass, where you talk to the people and they tell you things and you have to deduce things about them from what they tell you. I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, there's no excuse for it. I think it's a little more basic, actually, because it's earlier in the game. But still, you know, it's that to me is, you know, when you've got the engine, you've got everything else, I don't really like the fact that they recycle those kinds of elements. But in general, it's good. And yeah, the soundtrack's better, more varied, although there's still some repetition. And I'd say that the story and the cutscenes are better, even though they're still pretty lightweight. You know, there's not any kind of epic story. It's a silly kind of side story, but Link and Zelda have this cute little duo dynamic going on that kind of keeps things moving. So it's done well enough in that regard.
The funny thing is, despite my indifference to Spirit Tracks, there's a good chance I might pick it up this weekend because I heard Target's got it for $25.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cheap, and I'm about to do some traveling, so
depends what you like about Zelda, but, you know, if you like the dungeons and stuff, I think you won't be disappointed. You know, it's kind of fresh and kind of good in a lot of places. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, if it had been the first DS Zelda game, people still would have talked about the fact the exploration has been pared down pretty severely from its console versions, but I think people would have been really blown away because a lot of what went into the positive reception of Phantom Hourglass was just that people were impressed with how well they sort of distilled the sense of Zelda with this completely new interface. And of course, that novelty is not at, not present at all here. But what you have got is some really well designed dungeons and stuff to actually utilize it this time that I think Phantom Hourglass was a little bit lacking in. So yes, it loses its impact, you know, once you've played something very similar 2 years ago, but it is still that good, you know. So if you get it at a good price, it's reliable fun.
All right, well, maybe I'm ready for $25 worth of reliable fun. Jamesy, wrap it up, please, with a big game.
Yeah. So
big deal.
Yeah, so we have in my possession some hands-on time with the Skycrawlers, the Innocent Aces title, which John must have been lured to sleep because he's made no commentary so far.
Well, you know, I mean, you had the name and they took it from you, so.
Yeah, I know. I should file a complaint. But
Loss of innocence,
if you
will.
It's Ace Combat on the Wii.
It is and it isn't. So it's heavily levied on the Ace Combat game style, but one thing I've noticed is, inappropriately enough, because it's turboprop engines, is that it feels a lot slower, and you have to get a lot closer, which makes the game feel different. I'm not quite sure how to put my finger on how it feels different yet, but it's a lot of the Ace Combat games, the majority of the enemies you're going to blow up at a distance. You may not even see them. It's fire and forget, and you're just, all right, I've released my missile. I'm going to go ahead and do something else now. These ones, you have to get right on their ass and shoot them down.
Does it make you feel a little bit more tense, maybe?
It can, yeah. The problem is, and just like the Ace Combat game, most of the enemies are moronic. So you can get position on them and take them out in a few seconds. But there are these battles with aces that can be... I don't feel particularly threatened by them, but it is a challenge to get them in position to shoot them down.
Well, I guess the big question with this is the motion controls, so
yes.
They perform.
It's weird. So to explain these controls, what they tried to replicate is the control layout of an aircraft. Well, the control layout of a dual stick aircraft, which is one stick is used for side to side motion and up and down, and then one side is used for the thrust. So the Wii Remote is for your speed. So if you bring it up towards you from a neutral position being 90 degrees to the ground, you rev the engine up, and if you bring it down, you drop it to low speeds. And the nunchuck is used like the control stick, so if you tilt it in any direction, the aircraft responds accordingly.
Does it feel responsive?
It does, but not how you'd expect it to. It felt really really odd for the first few missions. Like, it was like I was able to effectively deal death from above, but it felt very strange. Like, I didn't feel like I had control of the aircraft. But as I was playing it, and I tend to play these games standing up as a function of how the room's laid out right now, just because the sofa's not in a place where it's convenient to see the screen the game system's being played on. So I was actually holding the two controllers in the air, which makes them a little bit more feel floaty. So I had a tendency to just throw my arm to the side to try to make a hard turn, where in reality, you just have to tilt it like it's a control stick. And it works just as fine. It doesn't feel real analog, although there are perceptions I've been able to observe that it does appear to be analog. I just haven't been able to sort of come to terms with that yet.
Because it's not something that, you know, with that, in the absence of Motion Plus, the Wii Remote's necessarily been the best at in terms of like a smooth detection.
And
of,
it's not.
Of things.
It's not real smooth. But I mean, it's manageable. So when I sat down, just to see what it was like sitting down, even though I had to crane my neck, when I sat down and put one on one knee and one on the other, that sort of restricted the wild arm movements I was making before. And it sort of forced me to use them like control sticks of an aircraft. It did work pretty well. And it kind of makes me just wish they just released a damn joystick and I could play it like that. But
yeah, I mean, because it has the option to use the GameCube controller and all that. Obviously,
because you're
playing it for review, you know, you would want to put the control schemes through their paces fully. But would there have been, do you think, if you weren't playing it for review, a temptation to revert to the more familiar control scheme?
No, because after a few missions, I kind of got it down.
Right.
So maybe if I were playing on the super hard difficulty versus just normal right now, I would feel compelled to go to the control scheme that would make this easiest for me. But in reality, I never really fought the controls. I spent more time fighting the physics of these aircraft because, well, because they're not big jet planes. And jet planes
they're
are
not
F-22s,
right?
Right, F-22s
can stall and
yeah, and they're going at Mach 5, so they're not going to have tight turning radiuses, but they have better aerodynamics, so they can manage these turns better. Whereas a lot of times, if you're trying to take a turn in this, you know, it's World War II inspired aircraft, you're going to feel resistance from the wings of the plane to making that turn, and it's going to try to hold you back.
That's cool, though. I mean, at least it's not just a total rehash for you.
No, and if it's actually more the end of the Ace Combat missions, what they do, and they've always done this as far as I know, is they show this like grid that was the map, and they show these lines, which are basically every aircraft in the area, and they show them interweaving through the mission. It's a lot more interesting to watch those in this game because you do have to get up close and personal. You can see these really tight moves that people were making to try to get away from you. Or in the case of with the other person's aces, you see what you were doing and you realize, damn, I was really making some hard movements there to get out from behind this guy.
Well, James, how's the Skycrawler story working out for you?
It's its own story. It's independent of the story of the movie.
Oh, really? Have you seen the movie then?
I have not.
I think it's on DVD now in America, right?
I believe it is, yeah. I might go get it. It's I would say there's more than a handful of, you know, a few minute long anime sequences done, and they look good. They're done by the Production IG, which is regarded as one of the better teams. And
they did the WarioWare, yeah.
Right. Wario Land, yeah.
I'm sorry, Wario Land, yeah. Christ.
Yeah, they're regarded as being very, very good. It would be nice to have seen the movie because I think it would have given me more information on the world in which it's set, which is information I don't really have at my disposal. I just kind of understand, you know, the story I've got going on here, but they don't really explain the conflicts that are going on and, you know, what the hell you're doing. All I know is these are the two parties because they've used their names. Like, I didn't even know the name of the organization I was a member of until the second or third mission. Because it's heavily leveraged on the environment created by the movie.
Okay. Well, based on what you've played so far, do you think this is one of the big, you know, kind of hardcore Wii games of early 2010?
It's a game I think that would be on that second tier. After you've burned through your hardcore, your like core hardcore titles, you'd say, okay, what should I get now? That game should be in the consideration. It shouldn't be maybe in your top five. But in your top 7, top 10, I could see it sliding into there.
So the market for Skycrawlers is people who plan to buy 7 to 10 Wii games in the first quarter of 2010.
Well, yeah, obviously. All right, fine. Maybe it should be in your top 5, but not your top 3.
Well, how would Ace Combat fans like it? If you like Ace Combat on other platforms, is this worth buying?
They'd probably feel it's slow.
Yeah.
And it is slow. I mean, it's the Ace Combat games, you can come up on somebody from 5 kilometers away in like 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You close that gap quick. And battles don't tend to last very long. There's not a whole lot of dogfighting in the F-22 Raptor.
Yeah.
It's over pretty quick. These things, you know, it can take a long time to close. The fights can... I mean, I had a dogfight go on for 5 to 6 minutes.
Hmm.
Just because it was so hard to get in position to finally finish them off.
James, have you ever played Crimson Skies on Xbox?
I have, yes.
It sounds kind of like that, which is good. I mean, Crimson Skies is awesome.
It's kind of a mix of the two, actually, yeah.
Okay.
It's the same kind of world, and in fact, there is a super death-dealing dirigible in Skycrawlers, much like Crimson Skies.
Again with the dirigible.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure why people felt the need to weaponize dirigibles in video games, but it is what it is. In fact, it has a very large cannon that comes out of the dirigible component of it, which seems like it would greatly decrease your buoyancy, but I guess physics isn't a primary concern here.
Just as an aside, would decrease buoyancy.
It is a very, very odd mission, that particular mission. I'll put it that way. Because you're just flying around a fucking blimp with guns on it. It's just like, okay, sure, why not?
So can you just shoot the blimp, like the blimpy part of the blimp?
No, it's made of metal. It's a metal blimp.
Oh, of course. Of wow. course. Because it's a fantasy land where they make metal blimps that float.
It's made of unobtainium.
Let me put it to you this way. I dropped bombs on the blimp, and it did not feel the effect of that.
Oh, good lord.
Like, big, huge, explosive bombs.
Yes.
So it's an interesting game. I'll put it that way. That's not the bad kind of interesting. It's just it's a different experience from its counterparts in the Ace Combat series.
So it's not ha-ha funny. Right. It's just funny.
There's a little ha-ha funny in it. Some words in there, like, maybe they made more sense in Japanese. maybe they should have renamed one of the groups from...
Or the game, for that matter. Aces? It doesn't... I don't know. That's always struck me as kind of a peculiar title for a game.
There's kind of a reasoning behind that.
Okay.
But, like the use of words like Kildren, which is just... ridiculous. Yes. Oh. Like things that just should have been rewritten in localization.
It's starting to sound like that Dreamcast survival horror game whose main character was named Jessica.
It's terrible.
I wish I could remember the name
Jessica.
Of it.
Oh, Jessica. God. Oh, God. That's amazing. Was that Blue Stinger?
It was one of those. Like, it might not have been Blue Stinger.
D2 or something like that.
Or
yeah.
Maybe there was one that... There was one that the people that made Blue Stinger made after that. It's meant to be very, very bad.
You know, my cousin is going to have a daughter in the next few weeks, so maybe I should go recommend that name to her.
Jessifer. I don't know if you should do that. Okay, well, that's Skycrawlers, James. I'm glad you're finally playing it. I mean, it sounds like it might be, a bit mixed, but...
It's fun.
You know, I guess what you can say... really in Skycrawler's support is that there's not really anything like it. I mean, there are a couple of flying games on Wii that are pretty bad, I think.
Oh, yeah, Wing Island. Wing Island is terrible.
Yeah,
unimaginably bad.
It's like, until this, really the only quality flying game that I can think of on Wii is probably just that one mode in Wii Sports Resort.
You're just shooting balloons.
Right. It's not,
which is pretty sad, considering what it could be, done.
Yeah, I wonder if the Motion Plus might spur something on.
You could take the flying game out of Wii Sports Resort, spruce it up a little bit, and make a good game out of it.
Yeah, I think
like
you could.
A game I would pay full price for.
At one point, we thought Nintendo was going to do that,
and then they didn't.
Still might. No. You never know.
Well, it's going to be in Zelda, so and
oh,
they're going to make
yeah,
pilot.
Of course,
there'll
yeah.
be pilot wings.
Link's metal blimp, or maybe it'd be wooden.
That's right.
Metal cannon wielding blimp.
Well, it's time for a break. When we come back, your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website. Now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Christmas is less than a week away, and Nintendo World Report is sliding down your chimney, eating the cookies left for us, and leaving behind nothing but top-shelf Nintendo coverage.
Pedro Hernandez reviews Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Smash Up, a Super Smash Bros. Clone that he calls, quote, surprisingly solid.
Pedro also gives us his take on Mario & Sonic at the Olympic Winter Games, which in his mind is an excellent sequel that does justice both to the Olympic Winter Games and the Mario & Sonic universes.
We also have brand new trailers for Monster Rancher DS and Guitar Hero Van Halen, as well as new gameplay footage from Tatsunoko vs. Capcom.
As usual, don't forget to check out NWR's other podcasts, The Newscast and Radio Trivia. We'll see you next week and have a great holiday, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Free Nintendo. It's time for your listener mail, and John is reading the first one.
All right, MC writes, why is it that at least decent Wii games with offline multiplayer, specifically first-person shooters, are so difficult to find? I appreciate that with The Conduit, High Voltage was really trying to push the Wii graphically and didn't include offline due to graphical issues, but why have other developers followed suit? I end up taking out my GameCube when I have a party with my friends to play games. Smash Brothers and Mario Kart can do it. Even games like Quantum of Solace and Medal of Honor Vanguard, though not great games, still had decent offline multiplayer. Yet games like Call of Duty Reflex and Red Steel 2 don't even try. I'm willing to play a game with a slightly lower frame rate and resolution if it means that I'll be able to play it offline. I am all for pushing the Wii's online multiplayer, but the option for local would be really nice. Do you think that developers are even trying anymore?
Nintendo's trying.
Yeah, they are.
Yep. New Super Mario Bros. Wii. Says
yeah, but he's talking about, really, first-person shooters. I mean, sure. If you look at his examples, look at his discussion. And I think one of the obvious reasons, and this is going to seem silly when you think about it, it makes sense, is the control. I mean, if try using a pointer, but you're only using a quarter of the screen.
Yeah, when you're shrinking it down, I think
it's a good point.
Two-player, it's probably maybe somewhat workable. Yeah, four-player.
The dots, your awesome dots.
I mean,
on
the
your
original
bar.
Red Steel had it, and I assume that was like a disaster, wasn't it?
Well, I never played it.
Red Steel's motion control was leveraged more on the accelerometers, the tilting function, than it was the pointer. And that's one of the problems with that game's control.
That was why I guess it didn't add to the disaster.
The Conduit is an interesting example because the Conduit actually scales down its graphics engine a lot just for online multiplayer.
In fact, sometimes it just scales down the whole game. It doesn't play it.
Exactly. Like the sad thing is that as much as they scale back the graphics for online, it still runs poorly. So that's really it wasn't an adequate solution to that problem. I think really the issue with the Conduit is not that they couldn't do split screen because of the graphics. I mean, that's a really easy excuse.
The control is probably a bigger issue, like James says, I think.
It probably is, and it's odd that they never really cited that as the reason. I mean, reading interviews, and they said, well, you know, we want to uphold the high standard of our graphics. No, you don't. Look at the online mode. It doesn't look nearly as good as the
I mean, that was the thing, though. I mean, their whole PR approach with that game was so much about the graphics going to be great, the graphics going to be great. I think it was just kind of like part and parcel of that.
It was two parts graphics great, one part you could do all these control options.
Well, that's true. I guess it would have fit into that too. But I mean, I get obviously. I mean, I'm gonna perhaps assume that MC who wrote this email, like quite a few of the listeners, or like myself, you know, we all had fun with GoldenEye and Perfect Dark, with split screen local multiplayer. And I mean, there's no doubt that local multiplayer is a different kind of fun. From online, you can be a lot more sort of raucous, and you know, obviously stuff like Smash Brothers and New Super Mario Brothers Wii, are great for that. They are substituting for all the kind of stuff you had on N64 that was the same way, like Mario Kart 64 and the original Smash Brothers, of course. But you haven't really got a satisfactory substitute with the shooter stuff. So
no.
I can understand the gap, but I guess it is just, you know, with the control setup and just with the idea of, like, you know, a lot of people are going to demand online, and then it's like, are you going to develop, you know, that amount of resources to online multiplayer and local multiplayer? I don't know, maybe perhaps it might take one game to actually really focus on a local only approach to actually do it.
Yeah, I think you'd have to really rework the control setup, though. I don't think you could use the pointer. I mean, you just have to think back to what it was like playing N64.
I'll have to go with classic.
Yeah, exactly. But I just don't know why somebody hasn't done that, like done something like Time Splitter style.
Yeah, but I mean, think about what it was like playing GoldenEye on 4-player split screen. It was really hard to see what the shit you were doing.
If you think about it, offline multiplayer, like split screen stuff, actually makes more sense now than it did back in the 90s, because now people have such big TVs.
Yeah, way bigger TVs.
You should actually be able to see what's going on a lot better.
A reasonable sized TV with a sort of widescreen configuration with a split down the middle. I mean, that could probably endure pointer controls. But it's an interesting situation, because, I mean, the Wii, some ways, like the N64, is definitely like the local multiplayer console. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about that, because online obviously is, you know, a bit of a mess with the friend codes or getting games seemingly to work properly is a bit of a struggle, as Brawl and the Conduit kind of go to show. I guess Mario Kart Wii is the best example.
The shining example.
I mean, I think there is, you know, certainly it's a very vocal minority, but I do think the group of people who are really concerned about this, especially for something like first-person shooters, it's kind of a niche audience, but there are probably enough people out there to make it worthwhile for maybe a download title where you wouldn't have to sell as many copies of it to turn a profit.
Yeah, I mean, what about some of those ones that Hudson have already done, like Onslaught,
like
John, John, you've got that, and then yeah, Water Warfare came later.
I think they're only online. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem like something that, like you were saying earlier, if you really made a dedicated effort to create a game for split-screen multiplayer, and you marketed it that way, and you said, well, you know, it's for download, but you know, obviously, you only one person in a group of friends has to buy it, so it's a pretty low cost of entry, and then everybody else comes over and plays it together. That makes sense. You know, another option for this would be to allow for some kind of LAN play, which Nintendo experimented with on GameCube, never really went anywhere. It was actually surprisingly popular on Xbox with Halo for a while.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. But the problem is there's no hardware with which you could network the Wiis together, short of creating an ad hoc Wi-Fi network, and those are...
You certainly could do that.
You know, it's not like the GameCube where you could just hook all your GameCubes up to a router and just say, oh, we're done.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of the problem is, you know, and this was an issue with GameCube as well, is that the Wii doesn't have a built-in Ethernet port.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If it did, it would be pretty trivial to put through a crossover cable or dump them all to a router. But because you need a separate adapter, you're really never going to see that. So.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, he references Red Steel 2, but that's eschewing multiplayer altogether, isn't it?
Yeah, that is an intensely single player experience.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not as if it's just focusing on online.
I don't think it would work multiplayer, to be honest. From what I played, it feels not like a shooter, more like an action game.
Well, I mean, I think, like I said, in some ways, I'm in favor of, you know, not trying to make a shooter. That's absolutely everything to everyone in terms of it's an online multiplayer, it's a local multiplayer, and it's a single player, and it's all great. You know, there is an element of dilution there. So again, you know, I'm kind of encouraged by what Red Steel 2 is doing.
Well, I think you might see Conduit 2 have it put in there, since they have they have everything else.
There's another sink to throw in.
Got to tick a few more boxes, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, the thing is with them, it's like, you know, I mean, they've kind of done all the heavy lifting, right? They have all the online stuff in place.
I would disagree.
Well, I mean,
there are many things that need to be lifted and pulled out of the crap hole.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, performance of that game aside, graphics aside, I mean, they have all that stuff in place. The only thing that game is missing is local multiplayer.
Certainly a lot less work to do than there was the first
time. Functionally, the only thing missing is local multiplayer.
It'd be more kind of viable to think about dedicating resources to something as kind of peripheral as a local multiplayer, you know, engine modification.
Yeah.
The Conduit 2 hasn't actually been announced. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but they have announced a game called The Grinder.
Yeah.
And I haven't looked this up, but I want to say that High Voltage has already kind of promised that they're looking into offline multiplayer for The Grinder.
They have a couple times now.
Yeah. Of course, it may get cut. It certainly could. I don't think they ever actually promised it
as a feature, though. I think it was always, you know, exploratory statements.
Right, yeah. But that's, you know, that's probably more than they did with The Conduit, so...
And of course, that's a co-op game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a Left 4 Dead thing.
Yeah, it is a Left 4 Dead thing, to be honest.
It's kind of a blatant ripoff, but...
With werewolves,
The Grinder, it's weird. I haven't heard anything about The Grinder since E3,
I think Aaron and I are the last press to ever see The Grinder.
it's gone dark. Well, you know, I want to say that originally they had planned to put that out early 2010. So if that's
like
on
that.
Schedule, that might be coming out, you know, within the next 3 or 4 months.
I was thinking like early Q2.
Okay, April.
Maybe mid Q2, somewhere in that range.
Right. That game might be ready for a resurgence in terms of information.
Or it may have been Project Hammered.
oh boy, that's great. So yeah, I mean, I you know, it's sad, and I totally sympathize with MC, because I do feel like that era of gaming has sort of passed us by at this point.
But you've got to say, I mean, compared to the other consoles, the Wii has really great local multiplayer experiences. I mean,
but they're not split-screen first-person shooters.
Yeah, leaving the shooter part of it aside, though, I mean, no other consoles carrying the sort of N64 torch, if you like.
Yeah, of course.
In nearly the same way, you know, with Brawl and Mario Kart and New Super Mario Bros. Wii now. It's, and I mean, that's the thing about New Super Mario Bros. Wii in a way that's it's kind of, you know, how against industry trends it is that, you know, here's a game that is very strictly focused on, you know, local multiplayer. I mean, that's just not common anymore.
Well,
at
all. They would have put it online, but the Wii's not powerful enough.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. We have our answer. It's just not powerful enough. The end.
So,
right,
Greg,
from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, I've got the next one here. This is Kyle from Delaware, and he writes, I am a 32-year-old gamer, and readily admit my skills have deteriorated in the past 20 years from my peak of 10. I still do well at games like Mario Kart and Zelda. I have beaten Twilight Princess, No More Heroes, Call of Duty World at War. I do find that many of the old NES games I struggle more with. I'm not quite as good at the first Super Mario, but get almost as far as I ever did before. Mario 3 is more difficult now, but I am satisfied with my progress. Then there is Super Mario World, and I suck. I mean, I am really bad. I have spent about 10 lives up to this point at Donut Plains and haven't beaten it yet. I was curious if many older gamers are finding the same issue. Why is it we can handle the more complicated controller and demands of modern games and be so flustered by a platformer from 1991? I'm loving Galaxy, but it casts serious doubt on my ability to be competent at New Super Mario Bros. Wii.
Games used to be harder.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what it, I mean, nobody's going to make the kind of games they used to make back then, except for, like, Team Ninja.
Because that's...
And the Mega Man 9s and 10s and rebirths
of
the world.
No, Mega Man 9 is not as hard as, like...
No, it isn't. I played it pretty close to 2, and I'd say it isn't quite as hard. But it's in the ballpark.
And 2 is not even the hardest game. Like, if you go into the early X's, those are the hardest games I've seen.
Mega Man, the original Mega Man, is fucking brutal. If you want a hard game, download that shit. But, you know, I think it's a little bit oversimple to say that games were just harder back in the day.
I mean, they were.
Okay, but it depends on how you look at it. I mean, Kyle makes a good point that he actually has no trouble with modern games, which are built for, you know, much more complicated controllers with more buttons. There's more to keep track of. I think maybe what we're looking at here is not so... one-dimensional as games used to be hard, now they're easy. I think now they're more complicated in a lot of ways, but they demand less raw skill from you in terms of timing,
the twitch reflexes,
in terms of dexterity,
physical
timing,
dexterity,
things like that. Right. Now you have to keep up with more, you have to manage the controller more, you know, they're more cerebral in a lot of cases. So, maybe it's just a matter of our skill set as gamers has, you know, been shifted over time by the kinds of games that are being made.
Well, also, you have to remember, too, that, I mean, like, all of the games were like that back then, so therefore you just basically got trained in playing those kinds of games.
Yeah, it's a question of a number of things. For instance, the tolerance to memorize level layouts and things like that. Essentially memorize them. Because, you know, these days you may well be a little short on that compared to what you were as a kid when, you know, that's what games were. You know, so you didn't throw your control pad down as a 6-year-old, go, this is horse shit, why am I being made to learn this? Because that's what you did. Whereas now you may well ask whether your time might be better spent.
Well, because the answer is yes, it would be better spent. That's why we have the Super Guide.
So I mean you're right, it's a different kind of difficulty, but I mean, in terms of the, you know, in terms of your skills, you know, decaying over time in general, I mean, maybe, yeah,
your twitch reflexes, I
think so. I think that's probably but I think more of it is just like how I think it's difficult to be as engaged with older games now as you would have been when you were young as well, because I think with the novelty of them and, you know, in many cases how technically impressive they might be when you were playing them as a child is so impressive, and, you know, that it would really draw you in and you would be very, you know, laser beam focused on the game and really wanting to play through it and stuff. And I don't think an older game, or even the newer games as you get older, are going to command that kind of, you know, immersion and focus when you're an older person, because it's difficult to summon that kind of enthusiasm.
I agree.
I think if you're interested in keeping, you know, or regaining some of your older, you know, more nostalgic skill set as a gamer, one thing, I mean, you know, I played, and we all played Super Mario World over the summer for Retroactive, and I didn't really have any trouble with it. I did find that some stuff later in the game, like by the time I got to the forest area, was fairly trying, you know, and I really had to concentrate on it. But up until then, I didn't really have too much trouble. But also, you know, maybe that's because I play games like that very frequently. So the stuff that I play currently at any given time tends to be a pretty good mixture of old school stuff and new school stuff. And and it's not necessarily old games. It's not that I play Virtual Console every single day to hone to keep up my skills or anything. But even more modern stuff, a lot of what I tend to gravitate towards is often leveraged on the older stuff. So, I mean, in a given day, like, there was probably one day this week where I played Blaster Master, Rock Band, and Mass Effect all in the same day. And those are those three games require such dramatically different kinds of skill that, you know, like, that's just the kind of eclectic mix that I keep up, and I think it kind of keeps me sharp on a lot of different fronts in terms of kinds of games that I'm able to play.
Yeah, I mean, say for instance, if you, like, were strictly a console gamer all this time, you didn't really play a lot of portables, I mean, that would probably contribute to your skills in some of those areas atrophying over time, because obviously, you know, the GBA was like reliving the 16-bit era in a lot of cases, and DS has got stuff like Hatsworth, and you know, so if you haven't been dipping your toe in those sorts of waters, I could see the kind of decay there. But one thing that I think is interesting is the idea, you know, how many games have really got the courage to actually design it so that, yes, the controls are more complicated, the gameplay is more sophisticated, but at the same time demand a similar level of skill as older games did with more simple gameplay. And I mean, the example that comes to my mind is Sin and Punishment 1 and 2. That's what kind of makes it quite unique, actually, is that, you know, the controls seemed really quite a lot to get your head around in the first one, but, you know, they didn't compromise on the complexity of the action because of that. And now with the second one, the controls are sort of simpler in a way because of the pointing and shooting, but, you know, it's still relatively complicated compared to really old school games, and I mean, they just go crazy with it and really ask a lot of you. So I guess it's really is a very small set of developers, because I can't, other than Treasure, that do things like that, though. I mean, has anyone else got any good examples?
Not off the top of my head, but I do want to say to Kyle that, you know, it sounds like what he's really getting at here is that he's concerned about playing New Super Mario Bros. Wii, because he seems to be having trouble with Super Mario World. I don't know. I tend to think that Super Mario 3 is probably more difficult than World.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, I would say so too.
If you're doing okay at 3, it may just be that you're having a little bit of trouble coming to grips with the physics differences in World, because Mario controls a little bit differently, and you got Yoshi, and that's kind of a complicating factor. But, you know, New Super Mario Bros. Wii is, from a mechanic standpoint, very simple.
Yep.
And so it does kind of straddle between 3 and World in a lot of ways. So it's hard to say whether you'll have difficulty in those terms, but what I will say is that, you know, other than the obvious stuff like Super Guide, you also have really, really abundant one-ups, and if you ran out of one-ups, I don't think anything bad would happen to you in that game. It's not like you're going to lose your progress.
Not really. I guess you could, because the first time through, you kind of save every few levels. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could lose the clearance of like a level or two if you if you lost all your lives on a castle or something.
Yeah, but it won't send you back to 1-1 like in Mario 3.
No, not at all.
And you have the items. So they have all these mini games where you build up items. So if there's a level that I tend to think that most of the levels in the game they're mainly difficult when you try to rush through them, and you know, you try to play them really smoothly, or you're really going after the star coins. If your goal is just to beat the level and get to the end of the game, you can probably get through just about anything in there after, you know, 5 or 10 tries. And certainly the game makes it easy to take 5 or 10 tries on a level if that's what you need to do. And also, you build up this bank of items that you can apply to Mario before you go into the level. So if you're having trouble on a particular stage and you think, man, I wish I could just kind of fly over a lot of this shit,
yeah,
put on a propeller suit and just skip it. I mean, you can almost cheat. It's kind of like doing a P-Wing in Mario 3. You know, like if there's a really nasty level, you can kind of almost skip it. Not as totally as you can with a P-Wing. Yeah. But, you know, you can get through a lot of bad stuff just by flying over it. And a lot of times what I'll do is just use a mushroom. If I'm having a heart, because, you know, the mushroom just lets you get hit an extra time. And that can sometimes make all the difference. It's very, very easy to get mushrooms. So I think it'll take care. I think you'll be all right. I think you should play New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I really do. All right, James, you got the last question.
Right, so Rob writes, since listening to the game's soundtrack lets you take part of the game with you wherever you go, wouldn't it be a smart thing for developers to always include it in the purchase? It seems like including a standalone soundtrack would help link the fictitious world the game creates to the real world where we live. I know Atlas has done this with certain DS titles, but don't we all wish we had a Mario Galaxy score ready and available? Or readily available? Why isn't it? Couldn't they extend the life of a game? And even if a score really does have an effect on gameplay, and I'm not just imagining it, wouldn't the soundtrack inclusion eventually lead to composer popularity for the casual player and allow different avenues for marketers to consider?
I think you're stretching a bit with composer popularity, but...
Mm-hmm. I'm not stretching. Rob's stretching.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I do this. I listen to some game soundtracks, ones that actually deserve listening to.
You sure you don't do a bit of pro bono work here and there,
Jace? I'm not going to have, like, F1 soundtrack on my MP3 player. It's only got one song. And it's not particularly good to begin with.
Yeah.
A friend of mine happened to, completely out of nowhere, I went out to lunch with him last week, and this guy, I mean, he I don't even think he has a Wii. He has a GameCube. So he was playing the GameCube forever, right? I mean, he's not really a big gamer, but out of nowhere, I didn't even know he had a DS. But so he meets up with me for lunch, and he's like, hey, I got something for you. I'm like, okay. He hands me the soundtrack to, of all games, Chrono Trigger.
Nice.
And I was like, thanks. He's like, yeah. You know, I bought it for DS. I didn't know this at all. I didn't even know he had a DS. He's like, yeah, I bought it. He's like, I always heard way back in the day that it was a really good game, and I bought it, and I got this soundtrack with it. So I figured I don't need it. So here you go. So yeah, so I got the Chrono Trigger soundtrack just given to me out of nowhere.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I didn't even get one with a press copy of Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, and it's really cool. It has like the nice artwork on it. Comes in a little plastic sleeve. It's really cool. I don't know where I got it. I didn't even know that was a pre-order bonus for anything. Maybe you got it from GameStop. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the different culture around it. Like Japan, they seem to have, you can buy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's always retail, but they've got soundtracks for all sorts of games, you know, that aren't even necessarily that popular. In some cases, I think, like, you know, they had like a Fusion and Zero Mission the soundtracks in Japan, even though those games were far from massive on
GBA. Yeah, I mean, you can get, and here's Nick, I only know this example because I got three songs from the game through means because I really liked those songs. You can get a 4-disc collector's album of The Last Remnant in Japan, a game not designed for Japan. And sold accordingly on a system that Japan completely rejects.
I guess that's the question, though, isn't it? I mean, if in America or Europe, you know, that they started giving away soundtracks, you know, more often, and people kind of had a bit of a different perception of the music that is in games, could that actually lead to the growth of a retail market for soundtracks in the longer run, that people actually start to, you know, see it in those terms?
Yeah, I'm really surprised that, like, on Amazon they haven't allowed people to download MP3s, like, of the soundtrack, just kind of as, you know, to go along with it.
I think that part of the reason we don't see this, but we do see it with movies, is that movies have to fill that secondary market with merchandise because it's where they make a lot of their money, especially when the movie's in that dead time between theater release and DVD release. Mm-hmm. You need to fill it with money-making opportunities, and there's a lot of things to recoup. And I don't think video games ever really went into that same kind of marketing because there wasn't the huge amount to recoup.
You have had a few cases, I think, of giving away or making them available to download on, you know, iTunes or whatever. I seem to remember maybe something about Hatsworth. I might be confusing something
Hatsworth,
there.
But... Hatsworth soundtrack was available through EA's press site, and then they eventually made it available on their main site.
Right, yeah, there you go. And like World of Goo as well, I think, at one point. You know, yeah. So you do see it being used somewhat as a promotional device. And of course, digital distribution makes that a lot easier than going to the effort of actually printing... Yeah, copies right. and stuff. I mean, as far as like Galaxy specifically goes, obviously there was, I think there were two versions, two CDs of that in Japan, of single disc and a two disc version. And then I think in Club Nintendo Europe, there are some of the two disc versions available if you save up an ungodly number of stars.
Yeah, but it's like a billion stars. It's like more stars.
It's a lot.
Than the
yeah,
night
you'd
sky.
Have to buy a lot of games and not.
You'd
use
have to buy four copies of Dungeon of Pokemon Dungeon Explorer.
Oh god. So it's interesting. I mean, game soundtracks have carved out a weird piece of Japanese culture that they are considered kind of a legitimate genre of music. You know, in a record store. So they're not even just for otaku.
One thing I think nobody's ever done is actually tried to, like, say, get, like, you know, I'm going to kick myself for saying this, but getting something, some group like the Black Eyed Peas to do, like, the theme song for your game.
Stop.
Well, I think for Final Fantasy 13, they're bringing in Leona Lewis. I don't know anything about her, but apparently she is a person who does music.
That's just in. So she is a person.
She's like a name. I mean, it doesn't happen often. And, you know, maybe this is on the brink of actually developing in the West. We've got Video Games Live now, which has been going for 2-3 years nonstop, has been very successful. It's about to be broadcast on PBS.
It is, yes.
Which is kind of a big deal, actually.
Hmm. It's part of their Great Performer series, yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. So that seems to be gathering some steam. It seems to be sustainable economically. So maybe they're kind of proving that there's kind of a critical mass of people who want to go enjoy game music. Now, I think that just because someone is willing to pay to go see a live performance of this stuff doesn't necessarily mean they want to have a soundtrack for one specific game. Actually, what I could see as much more viable would be kind of a now...
compilation
of stuff from several different games. I think it's a little bit more difficult to market a single game soundtrack, you know, separate of like a pre-order bonus, to actually ask someone to go out and pay $12-$15 for the soundtrack to a particular game. To me, the number of people who would do that in America, for instance, is such a small audience. I mean, it makes sense digitally. It makes sense on the internet, where you can cater to very, very small audiences like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in terms of some parity with popular music, I don't see that happening. Not like, because it, for one thing, in Japan, that phenomenon goes back 20 years. So it's very, very well established.
Right.
And it goes back to way before the internet age and the iTunes age. So, you know, I think at this point in the West, it might be too late for that soundtrack market to develop.
If you were going to get it going, like, digital is much more of an obvious avenue, you know, and then maybe people get used to, you know, the being able to access it digitally. But, I mean, I guess the one thing about a physical CD that literally comes with the game is it's sort of so easy to just put it in something and see about it, rather than, you know, I don't know, like download codes or, you know, tell them to go to a specific website or this, that, and the other. Something physical or something that maybe, you know, like John said about the Chrono Trigger, that comes with nice artwork and this sort of thing, could, you know, I could see the appeal of that. But just, I remembered a really good example about Japan that illustrates the difference between the two with regard to this issue. I was surprised to find out once when I was doing some import shopping that Castlevania Judgment actually has its CD, its soundtrack release. That may well have sold better than the game in Japan.
I dare
venture to say. I thought that was wonderful.
Well, actually, you know, I was doing some research for this question, and I remember that Square Enix actually has their own music publishing wing.
So does EA.
Square Enix actually has bands they produce that do their games.
Well, I mean, they've been doing some really wonderful things for a long time, like, you know, the Chrono Trigger arranged album, that the was it Brink of Time or whatever, you know, like... Well, you got, I mean, like, symphonic arrangements for a bunch of different stuff. Like,
but, I mean, they have a rock band that's a bunch of Square Enix composers who just play Final Fantasy music.
Oh, sounds a little like Anuma's band, the Wind Wakers.
Yeah. Aren't they called, like, the Black Mages?
The Black Mages, yes.
Right.
And in fact, people on who were, like, were hired to be the guitarist for the Black Mages just slum around Square Enix music because they are just the guitarist. But
were they ringers? Is that what you say?
Well, actually, the guitarist, the only thing on his profile page was just other works for a long time, and then just out of coincidence, his first job he got was The Last Remnant, because Americans like guitars. That's what they come up with.
See, they thought about
the Black Mages don't perform very often.
No, they don't.
They've been around for long, long time.
But they've got like a ton of albums out now in Japan. I mean, just
even Nintendo are in on the act in Japan, aren't they? Like, there was the Legend of Zelda symphonic CD that went along with Ocarina of Time, and the Big Band CD, and the
I've
Smash
got the
Brothers.
Big Band CD. Yeah. I played it once. It's really cool, but I've said for a long time on Radio Trivia that I really like game music, but I only enjoy it in the context of playing a game. Mm-hmm. Like, TYP, if you ever ride around in the car with TYP, he will play game music. Like, that's primarily what he listens to. Almost, like, 90% of what he listens to is game soundtracks. And, you know, I respect that. That's interesting, and that's totally fine for his taste, but like for me, and I don't find it offensive, you know, it doesn't bother me at all. A lot of times it's like playing
it doesn't
radio
make
trivia
me wretch, so
no but it's just like, it's not like I'm gonna ask him to change. It's actually fun to ride around with 2IP because it's kind of like playing radio trivia in the car with him. But like, that's what he listens to all the time, and you know, I respect that, but for me, it that is not something I'd want to do. And it's, people give me game soundtracks. I have probably a dozen of them lying around all over the place. I never, ever, ever play them. It's just, I don't really care to listen to that music outside of the game, because what makes it magical is the combination and the integration of that music with everything else. I feel the same way about movie soundtracks. You know, like, I just don't, I'm not interested in hearing the score of a movie.
Certainly, as game soundtracks are becoming more cinematic, then you know, and it's about scoring the on-screen action, that really doesn't necessarily work that well independent of the action. You know, it's just, it kind of, you lose the context, you lose a lot of the impact and the meaning of it in that case. I could definitely see that part of it. And then I guess the biggest thing with the older music was, you know, it couldn't really be that sophisticated. So you had these really catchy kind of, that's what they were going for, you know, trying to make it catchy and you know, within the constraints of how simple the sound hardware was back then. I guess, you know, to be the most listenable game music is actually just rearrangements of those old catchy themes, because they kind of work outside of the game.
Yeah,
I think there are some examples that work fine. But to real quick wrap up what I was saying earlier, you can actually, just from poking around, you can't actually download a bunch of Square Enix music from their site now, like whole albums they have on iTunes.
Nice. And also, I would highly recommend ocremix.org. I think. Oh, the Overclock Remix guys, like, that's what Greg's talking about, kind of a lot of times they're like jazz or electronica rearrangements of classic game music, and that's some fun stuff, and some of that stuff, you know, like the jazzy rendition of the Super Mario 2 theme, like, I would actually put that on my iPod, because it's good jazz music.
Yeah,
and of course, like the Brawl soundtrack is like that, basically. I mean, a lot of the stuff in that is very similar to something like an OC Remix would produce. So that kind of works for me, because it is about taking something out of its original context. So it kind of works listening to it independently.
There's some weird shit on this website. You can get Chocobo's Happy Christmas from Chocobo Mystery Dungeon from 1997.
Oh, no. I know what James is going to get from Secret Santa this year.
Well, I guess amazing, though, would you think that, has there ever been a point where you've heard the soundtrack of a game, for whatever reason it might be, whether you're riding around in the car with TYP or various other reasons, as might, it would have to be for most people, that made you want to go back and replay that game itself.
Yes.
Well, not example, for me.
Metroid.
The original?
Or probably Super Metroid, where the dun 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 dun, that kind of haunting.
Well, that's in both. That's
yeah.
In both.
Yeah, it's done better in Super Metroid, but...
Well, yeah, obviously the instrument quality is a lot better. But mm-hmm. I actually recently got Chrono Trigger on DS. I haven't really played it very much yet. I mean, I haven't played that game in 10 years because I played it and it wasn't my copy. I borrowed it, so I haven't had the chance to go back to it at all. And a lot of the reason why I bought it is because I heard the soundtrack on something.
Yeah.
It was really, you know, because, you know, I remember playing the game a lot, you know, 10 years ago, and you know, that soundtrack, hearing it again, having not heard it for a long time, was so evocative of that time.
Yeah.
There was a kind of, that was an itch to scratch then, and I got a good deal on it and I bought it. And I could see, you know, in a way, you know, maybe you could justify including a soundtrack as a promotional extra, as a kind of way of sort of mutually reinforcing the game itself. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes maybe to get people to kind of, you know, remember it a bit more fondly or whatever, and maybe it boosts the word of mouth and sales in the long run or whatever. I mean, it's all a bit detached. There's, you know, so many degrees of separation and intangible, but, you could probably make an argument.
Just to follow up the question of if there's one that made you want to go back and play it, I would say definitely like a Phoenix Wright title has done that, where I went back and replayed certain parts of it because that music is just so freaking out there.
It definitely affects different people different ways, but I'm glad Greg kind of brought it back around to answering Rob's question about, you know, why isn't this done more often? And I'll give you a couple reasons. First, I think most companies don't care that much about reinforcing the experience of playing the game, because if they include the CD with the game, they've already got your money by the time you buy the game. So they don't care that much if you play it.
The argument would be word of mouth, that that in the long run sells games.
Sure. Especially on the smaller end, which is why Atlas does it, because they depend on things like word of mouth.
Yeah,
I think so. I think that's right.
To sell all 9 copies of the game they've made.
Yeah.
Right. But the other thing is, look, most companies don't even bother printing color manuals. You know,
no.
They just don't give a shit about packaging.
It's true.
Production value.
It's sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. Was it like Modern Warfare 2? They've got Hans Zimmer doing the soundtrack, but the manual's like a black and white one sheet or something.
Yeah,
exactly.
But see, I've always wondered why companies don't do something like something, I think Modern Warfare 2 is a perfect example, is why they didn't do something like music inspired by Modern Warfare 2. And they could have, you know, whatever, like every single rap artist on there, right?
Oh, no. Oh,
seriously.
No.
I mean, if they actually got I'm not saying shitty rap artists. I'm saying actually really good guys. Like,
you're
making, you
know, 50 Cent Blood in the Sand, aren't you?
I'm just saying.
Oh, bitch, took my skull.
You know as well as I do that stuff sells like hotcakes. And why and Activision has money out the ass, and to promote their game, I have no idea why companies don't do that.
My question is this: what would you rather get with your Modern Warfare 2? Would you rather get the CD of the Hans Zimmer soundtrack or the night vision goggles?
Definitely the goggles, for sure.
I think the night vision goggles really gets word of mouth going.
That's just amazing.
Actually, probably the most obvious and probably one of the better selling game soundtracks in the West has been for Grand Theft Auto.
Mm-hmm.
I think they started doing that with Vice City, and then they definitely had a big production for San Andreas. And
well, I guess they are like kind of like now compilations in themselves, aren't they? Except they're not.
They are exactly, and that's not music that was made for the game. Obviously, that's, you know, it's popular music that was used in the game. But you know, if you play those games and you really like the soundtrack, that, you know, which you hear quite a bit as you play it, and it's user selectable in most cases, you can go out and buy that. But again, in the age of iTunes, that seems a bit
pointless. They do that. Mm-hmm. Well, like like they do have some music on those games that is stuff that, you know, you wouldn't be exposed to otherwise.
Yeah, that's probably right. The best thing about game soundtracks. So Jerry, whether it's, you know, literally like popular music that it's drawing on in the case of that, or just, you know, the kind of some of the classical styles or jazz or whatever, that it's not the kind of music that you would seek out, but when it's presented to you, you think, actually, oh, you know, this is actually, I can enjoy this kind of music.
Well, this whole discussion is making me want to go play Little King Story so I can
nice.
Have some holiday music. Cause it's got the better part of the Nutcracker suite on that game.
It's a lot of the time it's related to how much effort they put into the music initially.
Oh, yeah.
That could be effort in multiple senses. You know, for instance, obviously with the Grand Theft Auto, presumably they had to pay a lot of money to license these songs. So, mm-hmm. you know, if they can make it back in a more direct way, they'll do that. Obviously with Galaxy, you know, they went to the effort of getting the orchestra together and recording this wonderful orchestral music. So it's no surprise that they did, you know, two different versions of it in Japan, right. All this stuff. So
you've got like the Square Enix projects where they'll make a 300 piece symphony play a 200 song soundtrack for your game. It's like not really necessary, but we appreciate the effort.
Stuff like Hatsworth and World of Goo, you know, the smaller games, but clearly they knew that they had good soundtracks. It was probably because they had put the effort in, and so you know, a lot of the time that the people who created those would like to see it take on a greater life.
Well, you know, Hatsworth did as the theme of the NFL in Europe.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It's true. Hey, you gotta keep getting it out there. But of course, on the flip
what
side,
a successful campaign.
on the flip side, a lot of the time, the music is probably, you know, foamed in, forgettable stuff, and there's no impetus to do anything with it. So it, you know, the idea of it kind of being an industry standard or something is you're pretty much a non-starter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to wrap up the mail here. Thank you everybody who wrote in, and of course you can have your letter read and discussed at length on this very podcast by sending it to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We really love hearing from new listeners, people who've listened for a long time, never wrote in before. Anyone with a good idea, if you have an interesting comment on anything that we've talked about today or previously or in the future, send it in. We'd love to read it.
About the future.
If you want to show us your awesome gaming tattoos, we're up for that too. So as for the remaining episodes of 2009, it's a little bit up in the air right now. We think we'll probably have one next week right before Christmas. Well, it probably won't come out until after Christmas, but we'll record it before. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen on that. I don't know if I will personally be able to be on it. It's kind of a little iffy right now because people are traveling and there's work schedules and holiday weirdness. But stay tuned. We'll cook something up for you, and we won't let you go more than a week or two without your dose of Radio Free Nintendo. So with that, thanks for listening. Thanks to the crew for being here, and have a great holiday of your choice. Bye.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Later.
Well, yeah, Guitar Hero was two games in one, and I'll say Guitar Hero 5 is excellent. You know, I'm not saying anything
and
against
come
that.
Come on, it's... I mean, if you bought Guitar Hero 5, you got a free copy of Guitar Hero Van Halen. I mean,
don't threaten me, John.
Seriously, I mean, how can you turn that down?
Easily, with my mouth.
I mean,
it's worth less
Diamond
than nothing,
Day.
I have to say.
Even his hair has turned down David Lee Roth, John.
Well, I mean, was it Mitsuda that did the Chrono Trigger soundtrack? He famously worked himself to the brink of collapse. So he
perfect.
Evidently put a lot of himself into it, and it is very good.
That's an unfortunate habit of composers to almost kill themselves.
Well, they're all crazy. They're all crazy geniuses.
or they're all bad at their job. It's
like
the
Mozart.
Other.
He made it fashionable.
I know.
There you go.
Yeah, indeed. He was killed by Salieri.
He was, yeah, in a black mask.
In my experience, either composers are like crazy geniuses who will work themselves to death, or are, just aren't talented and will work themselves to death trying to make up for their lack of talent. I've never met a well-adjusted... I've met at least 10 composers in my life intimately.
Intimately.
Really?
Not like that.
Trolling those like, music bars
like,
again.
Like
huh,
in
James?
A one-on-one setting where I got to have a conversation with them.
Classical music groupie.
Shut up. Look, I used to perform.
Excuse me, sir. Could you point me to the ladies' music school around here?
Oh.